Hello and welcome to the Crisis Point Podcast. I'm Eric Sammons, your host and the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before I get started, I just want to note for people to find all the different places Crisis is at lately. We've been going to different places other than Twitter and Facebook because they will eventually kick us off. So you can find this on Odyssey. You can find it, of course, on YouTube. Crisis also you can follow on Gab, on MeWe, on what else? Parler, on Getter, all those places. Because, like I said, eventually I think we'll probably get kicked off of Facebook and off of Twitter. Also, I would like to ask people, we're getting near the end of the year, so if you can donate to Crisis Magazine, we'd really appreciate it. You can just go to crisismagazine.com/support. And make a donation. Nice time to make a good donation. And also, we do accept cryptocurrencies now. So I'm very excited about that, of course, as you can probably imagine. And then also, finally, make sure you like and subscribe to the channel. I have a special guest today, and he's special for many reasons for me. But let me introduce him first and what we're going to talk about. So Dr. Nathan Schlieder is a professor of philosophy and religion at Hillsdale College. He has a BA in history from Miami University of Ohio and an MA and PhD in politics from University of Dallas. He is the author of One Dream or Two, Justice in America and the Thought of Martin Luther King Jr. He is the co-author of Selfish Libertarians and Socialist Conservatives, the Foundations of the Libertarian Conservative Debate, of which he took the wrong side. And he is also the editor of The Humane Vision of Wendell Berry. His articles have appeared in First Things, Touchstone, Logos, Communio, Public Discourse and Perspectives in Political Science. He has been a fellow of the National Endowment for the Humanities and the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutes at Princeton University. He and his wife, Elizabeth, who is a homemaker and homeschooler, have 8 children. And of all those things, none of them really matter for this entire podcast, except for the fact that he went to Miami University, because at Miami University, he was my roommate for 2 years. And Nate is the person who brought me into the Catholic Church. So welcome to the program, Nate.
Thank you, Eric. It's great to be on here. What a gift.
Yes, it really is. It is exciting. So this is going to be a little different than most of our interviews because we're mostly going to be reflecting on our time in college that led to me becoming Catholic. And you're looking at the person who's most responsible for that happening, other than our Lord, of course, and our Lady. And you know, just kind of talk about that. But in the context of evangelization, I wrote a book a few years ago called The Old Evangelization, in which actually the dedication of that is to Nathan Schlieder, who cared enough about my soul to drag me into the Catholic Church, which is kind of how it happened. I might have won a few of the battles, but he fortunately won the war when it came to my conversion. So basically, Nate didn't necessarily follow the script of how you're supposed to evangelize, and yet it worked. And so I want to talk about that because I think a lot of Catholics are hung up about when they know Protestants or if they have family members who have fallen away, what they're supposed to do, how they're supposed to do it. And I think it's a lot broader than what we think it is. So anyway, let's start off, Nate, with, okay, sophomore year. That's when we became roommates and we had 4 in our suite. If you remember, we had 2 Catholics and 2 Protestants and we're all, you know, practicing Christians. We were all serious about our faith. So as a Catholic going into that, what was your thoughts? Like, did you think going in, I want to try to convert these 2 guys? I mean, was that your thought process as a, how old were we then, 20-year-old? Or was it more just like, just kind of hang out and just see what happens?
Well, yeah. So let me go back just for a moment and say that I am humbled by your praise of my role in your conversion, but I feel a little bit like the whiskey priest in Graham Greene's novel, The Power and the Glory, because God just works in spite of him throughout the novel, all the way to the end. He's so defective in so many ways. And it's only through the sort of narrator's perspective that you get to see God's grace operate, especially on the boy at the end of the novel. So that's a little bit how I feel with respect to our friendship. To me, in hindsight, it looks very much like a gift to me and your own conversion, my instrumental part in that, just seeming to God using me in spite of all my defects. And I think we've talked about this before. You've talked about it as well. So I don't know that I'd recommend my approach, whatever that was. But in answer to your question, so whatever way we tell this story, it's going to have to involve my own conversion, because right. our sophomore year, when we found each other in this dorm room, this suite at Miami, was I think partly through the pro-life movement that we found each other, which right. was really a kind of unifying force for a lot that we did at Miami. And I think that although I'd been raised Catholic, I didn't understand very well the reasons why I was Catholic. I knew that I had a fairly strong faith life. I wanted to become closer to Christ. And frankly, when I came to Miami, my initial experience was that most of the students that I saw that really loved Christ were not Catholic. You know, we shared this experience. I think maybe we maybe even first met in Campus Crusade for Christ.
I think so. That's right. I think it was in Crusade.
Yeah. And I was really fired up about what I saw happening at Crusade. That wasn't causing me to doubt my Catholicism. I was not seeing a disconnect between what I saw at Crusade and what was going on with the Catholic campus ministry, such as it was. So, I mean, that's worth pointing out the kind of unique circumstances we were in there at that time. But just for your audience, you know, the Catholic presence at Miami was, we were pretty harsh toward it when we were there. And I think with a lot of good reason. Again, a bit in hindsight, I think the priest there was probably a very holy man, in his own way, confused.
He really didn't know how to reach out.
Oh, no. I mean, it was kind of the worst of 70s Catholicism that had creeped right. into the 80s when we were there.
And of course, the nun who was there made it even worse.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I mean, it was bad. But yeah. We didn't know how bad it was, I guess, is part of my point. And I don't think that anyone was really malevolent about it. It had just kind of right. creeped into a sloppy kind of community club-oriented Catholicism. If you remember, we weren't really even using the church itself for liturgy. It had sort of reverted to an upstairs room right. where they had all the masses. Which
Yeah, my first mass ever was in that. Like it was above a garage or something.
Exactly. It was above a parking space. Yeah, and in right. hindsight, what were we doing? Yeah. Why? Because it wasn't any bigger than the church, I don't right. think. I don't think it held any more people. But somehow it was more community-oriented to be sitting in folding chairs
yeah.
in this room than in the church, which was actually quite beautiful. So anyhow, so I was really attracted to the Campus Crusade for Christ kids. What I was really attracted to was what I saw, a very living faith in them. There was a vitality in their faith. They had a routine or practice of Bible studies and prayer groups that I very quickly became a part of those. And just in my naivety, and again, I wasn't formed well enough to see any dissonance between my Catholicism and what they were doing. But I even on several Sundays, I recall going with some of the Crusade kids to like the Baptist church, to a Presbyterian church, and finding them lacking in certain ways, but at least, you know, exploring, appreciating. And it was really kind of their fault, I think, because they started to ask me somewhere, you know, I maybe even in our sophomore year. So I had no plan to have you become Catholic our sophomore year. I don't think, I don't recall that I was, had become fervently Catholic until that year. And right. it was later into that year that began happening. And it was because, in part, some of the Crusade kids began asking me, why are you Catholic? Right. Why do you believe certain things that you believe? With the assumption being, I think, that we worship the saints and the Virgin Mary, and that with questioning things about belief in the Eucharist and the liturgy and sacraments and other things. And I thought, you know, those are good questions. And I hadn't ever, having gone to Catholic schools almost my entire life, my answer was, I don't know. Right. Which again tells you, you know, Catholicism was in such sorry condition in the 80s, right. You know, late 70s and 80s. It was just so bad. And God bless my parents. They're very faithful Catholics. They love the church, and they did their best. They still do. And
parents are awesome.
Yeah, it got through. I mean, you know, I think was my dad your sponsor? Maybe I was your sponsor.
You're my sponsor, but then what happened, since I didn't have godparents for my baptism because it was a Protestant baptism, your parents said, we will consider ourselves you're basically your godparents, your baptism, which I was like, this is great. This is wonderful.
Awesome. So cool. Yeah, I love it.
Which is great. So, and it's interesting what you're saying, because I'm looking at it from the other side, because you're saying that you found the Christians who were most serious about their faith were not Catholic at Miami. We got there, which is true. And eventually, one of the things that really led me to consider Catholicism was seeing Catholics who acted, as I would say, as Christians. And that was through our group, you know, people like you, obviously, my future wife, Suzanne, and others. But then also, like, you introduced me to people at Steubenville, because your brother, one or two of your brothers were going there. Right. And so I started to see, well, actually, Catholics can be on fire Christians, because to me, that was like a minimum requirement. Like, I'm not going to take your faith seriously if you don't take it seriously.
Right.
And in my experience, before I got to Miami and before I met you and our other roommate, Joe, I had never met a Catholic who took his faith seriously, frankly. I mean, I met your brother first, actually, who was dating my sister. That's how we first actually got to know each other and got in the roommates together.
Yeah,
but,
exactly. Yeah.
But I think that was, to me, was like you and Joe as my roommates. I was like, okay, here are Catholics who are actually serious about their faith. And as you said, you were growing in your seriousness about it. Joe already was. Mm-hmm. But then, like, you really were like, okay, this is something you can actually be from my Protestant mindset, I was thinking, you can actually be a serious Christian and also be Catholic, which I had never seen before. Something I had encountered.
Right. That was a very important element you brought up there in the story, which was our pro-life work eventually brought us into connection with Steubenville, in part because of the founding of the Ohio College Students United for Life,
right.
Which you remember, Greg was really instrumental in that. My older brother, Greg, was 2 years ahead of me in Miami. So our sophomore year, maybe 3 years. So was Greg a senior my freshman year?
I think he was a senior freshman year because he had just graduated, because my sister was 2 years ahead, but I think Greg was a year ahead of her.
So Greg founded Ohio College Students United for Life our freshman year, and then we got plugged into the leadership positions our sophomore year. And so we were jetting around trying to organize to start membership groups on various college campuses, and Steubenville was a huge supporter. And so the contact with Steubenville for me was really pivotal. I'd say there were two events that happened, and Steubenville was definitely one of them, where I saw the kind of spirituality that I admired in the Campus Crusade students fully embedded in the sacramental life of the church. I mean, that was the cool thing for me, was really eye-opening when we went to, I think we had maybe our first pro-life conference at Steubenville our sophomore year.
Yeah, it was October of our sophomore year, because I didn't go, but I remember you guys came back, because, you know, at that point I just started getting involved with pro-life. I wasn't really that much, but you guys came back on fire, because I think Suzanne, my wife, went with you. You know, not my
you
wife.
You have a great memory.
And there's a story behind that, because the first time I ever met my wife, my future wife, was in that dorm room. You brought her in, and I was a nerdy computer programmer. I was on the computer. She walks in. You're like, hey, Eric, this is my friend Suzanne. I literally turned and said, hey, and then she went back to the computer. And so my wife tells that story to a lot of people. She tells it to the kids all the time. She, in fact, she brought up just recently again, just to give me a hard time. She's like, she's like, lady, you know, to my daughters, don't go with a guy like that. But of course, she ended up with a guy like that. So there we go.
Well, now we have the real secret to my evangelization. You're doubly indebted to me for
your Catholic faith
and for your wife.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah.
The number one rule is find a beautiful, if it's a man, find a beautiful woman.
That's right.
And introduce them.
I should have put that in the old evangelization chapter one.
Exactly. That's as old as Dante. Come on. I mean, this is way back. You know, that's as old as Boethius.
That's right.
So we should probably at some point maybe talk more about the Steubenville influence that really affected the way we were living our faith the next 3 years. But the second thing I think is really notable, and it's an interesting story that I'm not sure you know all of it, but you do recall that the finding faithful faculty at Miami was not easy.
Oh, yeah.
And my memories were basically two, right? So there was Ryan Berrio, Dr. Ryan Berrio, who's still right there, and he was basically the faculty advisor for every conservative
decent group here, right?
You just go to Dr. Berrio. He had he was really memorable because he had that San Damiano cross on his wall behind his desk, which at the time seemed just so courageous to us. And he, at the time, maybe had six or seven kids, Catholic. So he was an influence, but also for the Protestants was this professor, Dr. Edwin Yamauchi, was in the history department. And he had translated several books in the NIV Bible, and he was active, at least.
He's a top biblical scholar in the world. And worldwide.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. A world leading scholar, especially in Gnosticism, early Christian Gnosticism. And there's a really interesting story on Yamauchi, and I owe a debt to him. I think we all do to some degree. But he taught an early Christianity, a church father's early Christianity course at Miami. And so I took that course, maybe first or second semester of sophomore year. And I got into that class, and all the Christian students took that class because it was kind of like wink, wink. Here we're gonna. Right. Now Yamauchi was very, very professional.
Absolutely,
and held his cards very close. He was not using this class in any way to proselytize. We call it kind of knew where he was, but that was the first time I started reading. The apostolic fathers were assigned in that class. And I just remember reading, you know, Ignatius of Antioch for the first time, the letters of Ignatius of Antioch. And I was just floored. I mean, that was really the beginning for me internally, was starting to read the apostolic fathers in that class and looking around in this class, like, are you guys reading this?
Do you see what I see?
About obey your bishops and the Eucharist is the flesh of Christ and Christ instituted the church. Like, we're just going through, you know, the Shepherd of Hermes and Barnabas and all these apostolic fathers that were these highly revered books. And then, of course, into the later church fathers. And that's when I got very, very excited. So that kind of converged with the crusade kids were asking me why I was Catholic, and I was questioning, and I was talking to my brother, as you mentioned, was at Steubenville. So I started asking him. I think maybe stumbled across a Scott Hahn conversion story somewhere around there. But reading those church fathers at that time in that class was just, I don't know how to express the kind of excitement I had at seeing my faith being expressed and elaborated historically and not merely biblically, because I'd gotten caught up in being required, expected to provide explicit biblical, scriptural support for every single thing that Catholics believe. And I was finding that difficult to find, as I said, explicit, you know, statements of doctrine or dogma. And so my whole sensibility for ecclesiology started changing in that class. Now, the thing is that, so at a certain point in that class, I went very much into my young, enthusiastic, obnoxious phase, which lasted about 15 more years. So for some people,
you're so good at it, you just wanted to keep doing it, right?
That's why I became a professor. I mean, somewhere it's probably related to that. You know, now I can tyrannize over people and get paid for it. But, you know, I just got so excited about it. And I thought, you know, how can you just not see, you know, when you look, it was sort of a confirmation for me of, you remember Newman's famous statement in his essay on the development of doctrine, which I did not know at the time, but the famous statement was, to be deep in history is to cease to be Protestant.
Right.
And I was seeing that in my own experience, and I was so excited. I just thought, gosh, you know, if you're at all smart, you know, and you just read this stuff, and you're going to see the truth of this. And so right. I became, I think, very excited to share that and very enthusiastic about it and probably a little over the top. The one digression on that story, Eric, is that when I took that class, there was a graduate assistant named Ken Calvert. He was a PhD candidate, came to Miami to study with Yamauchi. And I used to call him Ken Calvinist because he was a real Calvinist at the time. And we would get in these heated arguments after class. And Ken was very smart, knew a lot, but I was just frustrated he was not seeing the things I was seeing. And then years later, 2005, when I came to interview at Hillsdale College, the very morning of I'd not even met anyone yet. I was supposed to meet someone in the lobby of the hotel where I was staying. And I met that person. Another guy came by, and the person I met said, "Hey, let me introduce you to this guy, Ken Calvert." And both of our eyes were like, "Oh my!" I was like, "Okay, this job is done. I might as well just pack up my bags now because Ken is not going to be a fan." But Ken and I remained friends. He's a real powerhouse here at Hillsdale. He was the headmaster at the academy, and about 3 years ago, he came into the church.
Oh wow!
And awesome. I'm telling you, the guy is on fire.
That's great.
This is a guy who's got like the powerhouse of, you know, he came to study church history with Yamauchi. So he's got all of that. And now he's just a dynamo here on campus, doing courses at our church. He's now full-time back with the history department. I think Coming Home Network did an interview with him.
Okay.
But he tells a lot of the backstory of Yamauchi that I did not know. And I don't want to, you know, get off track on that, but if you want to hear it, you know, sometime.
Yeah, definitely. I'll try to find that put in actually in the show notes too.
Yeah. He'd be great to interview actually.
Yeah. That's
so great. Anyhow, so that's when I think we both, you and I, and it's a unique college environment, right? Where it's about ideas, it's about arguments. And I think we started kind of getting in arguments about matters of doctrine.
Right.
And faith belief. And that went on for a long time.
I feel like sophomore year, you're right. We weren't like debating like in a really intense way, because it sounds like you were kind of growing in your appreciation. But I do remember the summer, because you lived in Cleveland, I was in Cincinnati. And for some reason, we got together at some point, because I can distinctly remember this. We were in a car, and that's when you first told me to listen to the Scott Hahn conversion tape. And I've told that story a lot of times, but you're the one who gave that to me, because you had obviously heard it. You're like, "You can't believe this." And I remember still thinking when you gave it to me, you know, you're like, "Oh, this Protestant minister becomes Catholic." And I just had this thought of like, yeah, I think I wrote this in an article one time. It was like you had said, "Oh, there's a three-headed alien living under your basement." I mean, you know, it's like, you know, just completely nonsensical what you were saying. Like, why would a Protestant pastor ever become Catholic? But of course, listening to that was a big deal. But then it was in our junior year, that's when you really, I think, went in, your intensity level went up, because I remember you would leave what's now called Catholic Answers magazine, but at the time it was called This Rock magazine. You'd always leave those out. Because just for people who don't know, the four of us lived together sophomore year, but then it was just you and me junior year. So we were in the dorm together. Just the two of us, and so yep. you could intensify your work. But one of the things I just wanted to mention was one of the things that I appreciated that I think helped me was that your Catholicism was very natural to you in talking about it. And I know we could joke that you sometimes may be a little bit over the top on it, but you never hit it, in the sense that a lot of Catholics they don't want to say something that might offend somebody else or might be taken the wrong way. So they don't really talk. And, you know, we're not supposed to talk about religion in this culture, but you just did. So you didn't mind just talking about like praying the rosary to me. Okay, I'm going to tell the story here because I have to. So when you were over at my house, my Protestant house, and you bring up, you're all excited because you had a rosary that was green and yellow, and you said, it's my Green Bay Packers rosary, and you just bring it out right in front of my parents, and it was like, you know, I was embarrassed completely. I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe he's doing this. But honestly, that's being natural about your faith. It's not like you were saying, and now you heathens have to pray this. You still told me that later, but no. But what you were saying is just simply, you know, this is part of who I am. Having a Green Bay Packers, you know, colored rosary is kind of cool for you at the time. And I think that was helpful for me because it was like you were always evangelizing in one sense, but you weren't always trying to consciously. You were just living your faith out, and me seeing that then made me like, okay, this is important to him, and it kind of made me want to understand it a little better, if nothing else. So that was something, you know, that's the good, you know, the side that people need to know. But of course, you also went beyond that often. It's the joke between us, for those who are listening, that we got in some very, very heated, I'll just say fights. I mean, you could call them debates. That's probably we were literally yelling at each other in the dorm room about Protestant Catholic stuff, but also about stupid stuff. We debate whether or not Ohio State basketball or Indiana basketball was better, and whether or not an Ohio person like me was allowed to Indiana or not. And it was very clear that that was somehow a violation of
I was deeply offended moral. By that. I was deeply offended by that.
That's right, you were. But I do remember, like, and I do remember you, what you were saying earlier was, there was a frustration there because, I mean, you probably thought I was a smart guy. Now you know better. And so you're like, how could you not see these things that are so clear? And I, you know, now I have been Catholic almost 30 years now. Yeah. I can feel it too. You know somebody, like, you know, a good friend of ours who's still Protestant. He's a smart guy. He lives near me now. And I just am like, how can you not see? How can you not? It's so obvious. Yeah. But so... like, as far as like living the faith naturally, but then debating it, I mean, did you really have any plan of attack, or was it more just like, when it comes up, I'm going to make it very clear, I think Eric should become Catholic?
Well, that's great. Great question. I remember that story I just told about Ken Calvert, right? Which kind of illustrates you can have all of the kind of book knowledge in the world and just not see it, right? because there's a way of seeing that is filled by the sort of sensitivity of the heart to actually see the deeper meanings of things, or you can just kind of look at the facts in a more dispassionate way and not see those connections. And so the will is really involved in an Augustinian way, I think, at the deepest levels of learning. The will is involved, which means that ultimately there has to be a kind of inner conversion. Just, Lord, help me see. Lord, help me to see these things the right way. It's not like you're looking at any new information. You're just seeing that information in a different way than you'd seen it before. And I remember, I was very, it's a conviction I had from very early on, and one that I still very much have today, that people are ultimately deep down attracted to the truth of things, and that you don't need to beat them over the head with it. You know, the more you're trying to beat people over the head, there's a kind of anxiety that suggests a kind of anxiety about whether you really believe it or not, right? It kind of suggests an anxiety on your part, and that that deep down there's a way of just letting God's grace be the chief operating, you know, the chief principle in all of this. And I had to learn that, Eric. I had to learn that through my conversations with you very much, because I really did want you to become Catholic. I wanted to share that with you. Honestly, it was, a kind of source of sadness for me that we didn't, we shared so much. We were co-officers in OCSUL that junior year. I think I was president, maybe you were secretary or vice president or something.
Right.
And I wanted to share that. Because look, we were going to jail together. Might as well be in the same, you know, church at some point. You know, right. I just wanted to share that. And just for your listeners, going to—I don't know—at this part, maybe you'll have to edit out. But I think our records have been cleared by now.
It's a long time.
Our pro-life activism days that were all, in my view,
nonviolent rescue.
Nonviolent.
We were doing
still fully legal protests.
Yeah,
but. But you've told this story, I think, from my perspective, I recall that decision I made at one point, which was a moment of grace for me, where God said, shut up, just shut up. You're talking too much. And what you need to do is kind of be still and let me do a little work on this guy. Because you're kind of getting in the way now. You're just annoying him. And
I remember that very well because we were in a very serious fight. One of our fights is, I don't even remember what it was on, some Catholic Protestant thing. And I remember it kind of something snapped in me where I was just like, I can't talk to you about this anymore. And I was just like, I do not. And I said to you, I don't want you ever to bring this up ever again.
That's right.
And it literally was a month later I became Catholic. Because it wasn't that much longer after that, because you respected that. You completely were like, okay, I've obviously crossed the line here. It's not being very respectful of him if I just continue to do this. Because I remember my sister, like a day or two later, asked me, like, you're not thinking about becoming Catholic, are you? And I was like, oh, no, I'd never do that. And I meant it sincerely. I wasn't, like, trying to fool her or anything. And I always like to say that, like, you know, I want to talk about the rosary in a minute, but like, you know, you worked on me for a while, but Our Lady only took a couple of days. And then it was like, that is kind of, so there is a balance there between, it's not that you don't ever say anything. Cause obviously you said all these things to help me to kind of get the ground fertile, but just talking about it's not enough. That's not going to bring anybody to a sincere conversion of faith. Just talking. And I think, because you had told me, like, you know, that's the day I really started praying for you. I mean, not that you weren't praying before, but like you told me that's when you're like, okay, I'm really going to convert to prayer rather than just and leave it and let God do more of the work this
now. Right. That's exactly right. And I think maybe you would have come in sooner if I had shut up earlier.
Who knows?
I mean, it was, that's in a way I've changed with respect to that between then and now, because now I guess I see that people around in this culture are hungry for the Catholic faith is so beautiful, the way it permeates and penetrates so many dimensions of life and culture, art, family, the conception of grace in nature is so rich and beautiful. And I think it's deeply attractive to our culture, our sort of godless culture where everything is just adrift and the moorings have been lost. So I find now that I don't have to say as much as I once had to say.
Right.
That I certainly don't hide from it. Students know exactly. I've got San Damiano Cross. It's behind me somewhere up on my wall. There it is.
There we go.
Students know exactly where I am on these things. But they, in every case, are the ones that come and speak to me first about the kinds of questions they're having. Now, they've got fellow students that are pressing them probably just like I did at Miami, and it's a different age and there are different circumstances. But I do think that I could have been back then more prayerful, more gentle, more giving your heart a kind of freedom to work and move. And I was not good at that back then. So I can't say whether that assisted or not.
Right.
In it, but I certainly was excited. What one thing you did say really resonates with me, and I think it is true that I did not. I think our faith is just filled with these great goods that we should want to share, and not think that we've got to suppress those goods because they might offend people, or I mean, they want those. That's what I've noticed, is people around me are hungry for these things.
Right.
And we're so worried about offending them when in fact they're begging. Oftentimes this is what they're begging for, is this kind of these goods that can help them grow more deeply in the relationship with Christ. So,
yeah, I think it's interesting because it does. People get very, I think a lot of Catholics get very anxious about the idea of sharing your faith, evangelization, because they're afraid they're going to screw up. But the truth is that if you're really sincere and you're trying, then open-hearted and sincere people will listen to you. It's not that everything you said was perfectly said, or your attitude was or anything like that. It was just that I knew for a fact that you wanted me to become Catholic, and I knew you wanted me to become Catholic because you thought that was the best thing for me.
Right.
And so underlying every fight, underlying every maybe misspoken way you might have presented something, whatever, was I knew behind it, you know, this guy who I'm very good friends with and I value his opinion greatly really wants me to become Catholic. It's very important to me. So I should at least look into it. And so of course I did. And I still remember there was the one thing that really strikes me, because at the time, you know, as you said, the pro-life movement is very much part of this whole story. Mm-hmm. And I got very engaged with the pro-life movement. But as a Methodist, I was just scandalized because the Methodist Church had changed their position and become pro-abortion. Mm-hmm. And I'd seen other ones. So I was looking for another denomination, not the Catholic Church, obviously, but right. some other Protestant denomination. But I was worried, like the Southern Baptists, what if they changed their position, you know, 10 years after I converted, became a Southern Baptist? So I remember I asked you and I said, how do you know that the Catholic Church won't change its position on abortion? And you looked at me and you just had this look. We were outside. We were on a sidewalk somewhere in Miami. And I remember it was just a quizzical look, like, that is the stupidest question I've ever heard in my life, kind of. And you were just like, I just know. And it was said with such confidence. It's hilarious because there's nothing about that answer that's like some eloquent, you know, you're not being St. John Chrysostom here or anything like that. But it was that just assurance that you knew that the Catholic Church just simply can't change her teaching on abortion. And I thought, I want that, in the sense of I want to have that confidence.
Right.
That the denomination, as I thought of it at the time, isn't going to shift with the winds. It's going to remain true to the teachings of our Lord. And so that was a big one. And so, like, that's just an example where you didn't have to have some training in apologetics, or, you know, read some book, you know, by Newman or Catholic Answers or something like that. It was just like, since you knew the Catholic Church couldn't change, that was enough. And
funny parallel story on my side is I went on a mission with Campus Crusade for Christ. I think it was my junior year. I was like, this is great. I was all about praying with my fellow Christians. I would go to the, you know, noon prayer group several times a week. So I went on a mission with them during spring break, evangelization mission to New York City. And at a certain point, we were doing a kind of, you know, we did a kind of prayer. We'd come back from outreach to the homeless, whatever, and we'd do a kind of debriefing and then a prayer service. And during one of the debriefings near the end of it, I simply invited, I guess maybe that's a questionable way to put it. I didn't do a lot of inviting back then, but for lack of a better term, I basically said, this is so wonderful. We're helping the homeless here. And when we get back to campus, I hope to see all of you at our pro-life events. You know, the church has to stand up for all life. And I really want to see more of you. You know, we were always doing that. We always,
If
we could mobilize Crusade to our pro-life events, we would have this massive.
Oh yeah. That was our goal the whole time, was trying to get Crusade. Cause there was like 500 people students who went every single week to their gathering. And we're like, we can get them in front of the abortion clinics. We got this taken care of. It's kind of our thinking at the time.
And with God bless them, I mean, you remember how difficult it was. Right. And one of the mission leader took me aside after that, and gently scolded me.
Right.
And said, you should, you know, that's, you know, I don't want to get you the wrong idea. We're pro-life, but we're all pro-life here, but that's not what Crusade is about. We're about, and I, at the time, was just so, so indignant. I mean, again, you know, I want to have a little mercy on the guy, but it was a bad theological principle. And right. the whole kind of mere Christianity or minimalist Christianity of Crusade just became very, very clear to me at that point.
Right.
That it just all came into focus. Wow. We're going to sort of dilute the whole truth of the God. We're going to sort of exclude things just to have a kind of agreement around a sort of core center. But what's being lost here? And for me, a lot was being lost because, you know, it was, of course, the abortion issue and the pro-life issue, but it was also just like, if this faith is worth anything, if it's true, it's not going to be something you check in and check out with whatever your social causes are. Or you, it's not just something you do on your Tuesday nights or Wednesday night. You go, and suddenly that probably opened up a little bit of bitterness for me towards what I saw were some of the parachurch group
right.
you know, gatherings on campus. But I also think it all opened up a lot of apostolic opportunities for those students that really thought, hey, my faith needs to be fully, you know, I can't pick and choose off a menu the sorts of things I'm going to be in. So,
and we did get some people, some of the Protestants who were in those groups to come to our events, especially the bigger ones. I remember a number of them who would start coming regularly from, you know, your work and just trying to get them. So hopefully yes. That opened some eyes.
Very good. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I remember like that on the other side, one time we were going, I don't know if you remember this, but we were going to an abortion clinic and we had to park far away and we were walking to, this is actually in Cincinnati, and I really had to use the bathroom. And so like, I was like, there was a Presbyterian church. So I walked over there first to try to go in there to go. And there was a sign on the door, basically advertising the competing pro-abortion rally going on. And so I was like, oh man. So I was like, I can't go in there. Cause we had all our pro-life shirts and like buttons. So then we keep walking. I see a Catholic church and I'm a Protestant at this point. And I remember thinking how awesome it was to see a Catholic church. Cause like, I know they'll be fine with me walking in there with my pro-life buttons or whatever I had on.
Yeah.
And that was just a weird thing as a Protestant to be more comfortable going to a went to a Protestant, like a Methodist, some guy, it was a crapshoot whether or not they would kick me out or not. And so there's something, you know, like we say all are welcome and all that crap. Like I felt welcome. I really did. I felt like, okay, this is a church that they're not. And sure enough, the secretary there was super nice. She's like, oh yeah, sure. Come on in. Stuff like that. She didn't treat me like a homeless guy trying to, you know, get in.
It's a great story.
Yeah. So it's just funny how those things do impact you. It's not like she was trying to evangelize or anything like that. It just was simply the fact that the church was strong on this issue.
And that's another thing about that too. I mean, there are a lot of things to say about that particular issue, but I think our pro-life work, as I think back on it, necessarily entailed a kind of, implicitly, a kind of theology of suffering and of a kind of vicarious suffering. And, you know, when you're marching outside in the cold, freezing cold at these clinics, I noticed, you know, pretty early on, there'd always be like someone stood up with a microphone and a Bible kind of like yelling through the microphone. And then there'd be some crazy Catholics, you know, 30 degree weather walking around barefoot,
yeah.
You know, with a rose.
Like our roommate.
Yeah, exactly.
Joe did that a few times.
Fair enough. But I really found that there was no way to really be deeply in this movement without having a deep theology of suffering, understanding, incorporating the Paschal mystery fully into your sort of view of sanctification. I'm giving it language now that I wouldn't have had back then, but your whole view of justification involving a kind of incorporation of the Paschal mystery that was there in my bones and the liturgy and the sensibility of the things was so different than the kind of activism that I saw among some other pro-lifers. That was really important. I also, as an aside, do remember the great scandal of gathering a bunch of Protestants and Catholics together to watch the who was the talk show host? It was a famous show.
Oh,
back in the 80s.
Oh, yeah, I do remember this. I mean, I can't remember who it was, though. It was one of those, like, Jerry Springer types. It wasn't Jerry Springer, though.
He had slightly more civility, you know, slightly more decorum than Jerry Springer. I can't remember his name, but he did a special session, right, on abortion. And
right.
I think he had maybe Faye Waddleton or so, you know, someone from Planned Parenthood was on there. And then there was a Protestant person. And then there was a Catholic priest, head of theology at Notre Dame. Richard McBrien, it turned out to be. And I had all these Protestants in the room. I was like, here's now. I didn't know who McBrien was, but I thought my greatest selling point for Catholicism at that time was Protestantism is a little squishy on abortion, whereas Catholicism's pretty solid and strong. And then McBrien just scandalously misrepresented the church's teaching. And I'm just telling you, it just took the floor. It took all the air out of all the sort of apostolic work I'd been doing up to that point. It was so demoralizing. It's one reason I can never, ever quite forgive Notre Dame for all the good things that happened there. That was just so scandalous. Yeah. It's hard for me to forget it.
Yeah, and a few years later, I was actually doing a sit-in at the president's office in Notre Dame, getting arrested. So, you were up there.
Yeah,
were you at that one?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
okay, that's right. Of course. Yeah, right. Because Gary, Indiana. Oh, yeah, right. Okay, exactly. I don't want to give too many details to the prosecutors in Indiana, but anyway,
I jailbreaked out of that one to get to start at the University of Dallas.
Oh, that's right, because that was our senior year. Right, right. That was after I'd already became Catholic and everything, I think. So, yeah. So I also want to, the pro-life stuff was so essential because, the fact that our Catholic roommate did walk around at these things barefoot, that was so weird to me. Mm-hmm. As a Protestant, I had no way to, like, conceptualize what that meant. Well, I mean, I know it still would be odd to most, even Catholics today, but mm-hmm. But to my brain, I didn't see the point, because I remember asking about it. He was like, basically, he was offering it up. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, I did not understand that at all, how that fit in Christianity.
Right.
And that was, but those type of things really do start to impact how I viewed it. Like, I sort of realized, wait a second, Catholicism isn't just another denomination. It's like really a completely different mm-hmm. practice of the Christian faith. Mm-hmm. And so that was really, those type of things really made a big difference. And mm-hmm. one thing I want to segue to before we run out of time is I got to bring up the rosary because, you know, the rosary was, for those who kind of know my story, I'm actually probably putting the show notes to Mike. I was on Journey Home a few years ago and I talked about this, but when we were living together junior year, you bought got given to you a ton of those cheap plastic rosaries. And I remember you hung them on the lamp, like, remember those lamps with the arms? You hung them on the lamp on your desk and you put a bunch of, like, how to pray the rosary booklets under it. And I'm your only roommate, so while you're doing this, I didn't quite, you know, it's like, hello, very suddenly.
Yes, coming to visit our room. We had a lot of guests.
We did. We actually did have a lot of people. And you would like,
we were Hotel Central for
But I remember you saying to me something at some point, like, oh, hey, you know, got these rosary here if you ever want to pray them. Because the rosary to me, I remember at that point, my biggest scene in my mind of the rosary was one time after we had prayed at an abortion clinic, we were still there, the police had gone away, and it was getting dark. This was in Dayton, and we're praying, and the pro-abortion folks stayed. And they really started to show their true colors. And I'm convinced that at least some of them were possessed. I mean, I actually think that. I mean, I remember looking in their eyes thinking, this person is possessed.
Right.
They started yelling. They started chanting things like, kill the Christians, feed them to the lions. I mean, this was like intense stuff.
Right.
And I still remember looking at Suzanne, my future wife. I wasn't dating her at the time or anything at that point. And she's on her knees praying the rosary. And all the Catholics were praying the rosary. But for some reason, her image strikes me because there was this vile Satanist basically over her, screaming at her, and she's just got her eyes closed praying the rosary. And as a Protestant, that was very hard to process because I didn't know what to do in the face of this direct evil. What do I do? I mean I could read my Bible passage, I guess, but I didn't know what to do. I didn't have any of the resources to combat that. And here's this college student, because not like she was like some exorcist or something like that. She's just simply praying the rosary. And I remember thinking, like, and she was at peace about it. She just was ignoring. I mean, like, and I was like, wow, that was such a huge witness to me. mm-hmm. when she did that. And so the rosary meant something to me. Mm-hmm. And so if you remember, you would tell me about the rosaries. And then so sure enough, one day I grabbed one. And this is for the, here, I'm putting the camera, those who are watching the camera, I'm literally holding the one that I grabbed. I still own this. It's and I mean this literally, my most prized possession. I mean this, if the house burns down, we already said what we're grabbing. We're grabbing the kids, then I'm grabbing this, then we're getting out. The dog comes after this, I think.
I absolutely love seeing that rosary.
And so I remember I prayed it. And you were at, it was a Sunday evening. And you, and I won't get into the whole story why I decided to pray at that moment, but you were out at some meeting. And so I was in the room. I literally remember I knelt at the bed and I opened up one of your little books, How to Pray Rosary, and I read it. I mean, because I don't know the Hail Mary or anything like that. And I just went through it. And then you come home later and I said, you know, hey, Nick, I got to tell you something. I prayed the rosary. Do you remember what you said?
I remember very well.
Yeah.
It was, oh my God, do you realize what you just did?
Yeah, that's right.
You're done for.
That's right. And then
it's over.
Like, dude, you shouldn't have done that.
It's over.
Yeah. We said dude before everything back then. but you were basically like, dude, you shouldn't have done that. It's like, you don't, and it was like true. And like, what did you think though? I mean, obviously did you think it was all over at that point? That was just a matter of time?
I did.
Yeah. I mean, how can it not be? Protestant Prince of Rosary, Our Lady's got you.
Yeah, something something just was very deep in me that Our Lady, you know, when you entrust your needs to her, she's got it.
Right.
She's just got it. She makes it happen. She is just an amazing gift of our Lord, our Mother, who, she's so contrary to my own more sort of, what was it, sort of an aggressive masculine
right.
assertiveness. And she was exactly what, you know, I think you needed.
Right.
Of course, my remark was kind of spontaneous at the time, but I think it's really true. And by the way, if you don't mind, I know we're probably running a little bit long, Eric.
Oh, but, yeah, that's fine.
But I didn't plan this, but I just did get a letter last week from a student who graduated about 5 years ago, and she was Protestant and had a very, very difficult breakup with her fiance because he was active within her varsity on campus. He was a leader. They were engaged. She was very, very devout Christian, and she started getting attracted to Catholicism. And so she came to see me in my office, and we talked and talked multiple times, and her fiance was very, he was not liking her sympathy for Catholicism. And so she tells me in this letter, like I asked her two questions in this meeting. She wrote this long letter now. She eventually became Catholic, broke off the engagement, became Catholic, and is sort of a phenom. And I won't tell you who she is. But she wrote me this long letter of thanks, and I just got it last week, and she said, you asked me two questions. One of them was, do you pray the rosary? And she said, you know, I can answer the first question quickly, but the second question is what struck me. And she said, I decided, no, I've never prayed the rosary. I gave her a rosary book and a rosary, and she said, since that day, I have prayed at least a rosary a day nearly every day since. Our Lady carried me through that especially tumultuous season and continues to be a guiding light and sweet consolation. And it was like she never told me that she'd gone and done that, but I just said, pray the rosary.
Right.
You know, just give it a try. I wasn't saying, just give it a try. And she right. did, and everything kind of converged. And it's this beautiful letter she sent me of gratitude for what Our Lady did in her own conversion. So
it's amazing.
It locks into your
own story. I mean, it was 2 days later I decided to become Catholic. Because I told myself I would pray the rosary once a day for 7 days. And at the end of it, I would kind of make a decision and just stick with that. And I couldn't even make it to the 7 days because, I mean, and I really do think that's Our Lady. And I think you're right. Like, there is that balance there because your methods, like you said, are very masculine, very aggressive, and there is a place and a time for that. And there's, and it obviously was good for me because I needed that. I needed maybe a more aggressive approach to it because I'm thick-headed. Mm-hmm. But then like at that point, it's almost like you handed it off to our lady a month before. And then she was like, okay, that's nice, Nate, but now I'm gonna take care of. I'm gonna bring it into the end zone, so to speak.
Exactly.
And, you made it to like the 5 yard line on the other end, and then she did the other 95 yards.
That's about. I was gonna say red zone, but that's giving myself way too much.
Yeah, credit. Yeah, right. You brought it a few yards in. You at least got me into the field, and then she brings it the rest of the way. But it really is. It's a good point that Our Lady. You know, praying the rosary is probably the best thing we can encourage fallen away Catholics, non-Catholics to do, because I think she's going to be the powerful intercessor that will. I mean, she's the greatest evangelist of all time, and she doesn't even spend time. You know, we know almost nothing that she said, you know, from the scriptures, but yet, you know, she converted obviously the new world through Our Lady of Guadalupe. Yeah. And so it just really is that's a good. That's a good way. And I think I'd like to maybe we'll wrap it up with that because, you know, she gets the final word as always. So.
Oh, man, amen. That's a great way to finish out.
Yeah. I think. But thanks for coming on. And again, you know, I thank you. It's actually going to be 30 years this February of when I decided to convert, when this all happened, you know, the actual conversion. So
for a long time, you used to give me a phone call on that, on the decision day, but it's been a while.
So. I know. I feel bad because I did that every year for a while, and then I stopped because, you know, life, and I need to. But I think our gray hairs are kind of proving it was a while back. So.
Well, maybe we need to get together this time. And,
yeah, right. There we go. Yeah, for the 30th anniversary, we should or something. We're not that far away.
Yeah.
There we go. So
this spring.
That's right. So okay. Well, I'm going to wrap up there. Also, I just want one last thing I want to do before I sign off here is a little bit of a plug for Hillsdale College.
Oh, thank
because
you.
People in the audience might not know, because a lot of us know about the Newman Guide, which is talking about good Catholic colleges and great colleges on that. Obviously, Franciscan University of Steubenville, we love, we think it's great. You went to University of Dallas for your graduate program. My daughter went there. Great, great school as well. But Hillsdale College is not on it because Hillsdale College is not a Catholic college. Mm-hmm. However, why don't you give your plug for why a good Catholic family should consider Hillsdale for their children?
Thank you for asking that. I really appreciate it. So briefly, Hillsdale is a Christian college. It's not Protestant. It just says we'll remain Christian. And so it has a space. It's a space for Christians, various denominations to be there, but the Catholic culture at Hillsdale is incredibly strong. The core curriculum is very solid, and it's functionally a very Catholic curriculum, very much in the sort of great books of the Western tradition. And there's a very strong Catholic presence on campus, very strong Catholic faculty. We have a house called the Grotto, in which a Catholic couple lives, does ministry all year round. It's got a Eucharistic chapel, Eucharistic adoration, mass, confession. We've got a beautiful chapel you may have heard about. The architect was Duncan Stroike of the University of Notre Dame, who did Thomas Aquinas College's chapel as well. Ours is a lot bigger, holds about 1,600 people. And we have mass in there frequently, daily mass. And we've got a great parish. I'm sure I'm forgetting something. I teach courses in Roman Catholic theology, theology of the body. Maybe give it a focal point for your listeners, we can kind of leave it at this. One thing Hillsdale offers, in addition to a strong sort of spiritual and very strong Catholic culture, is an outstanding education. It's a really excellent education. We've had we've had 8 students in the last maybe 10 years clerk on the Supreme Court, which if you don't know, is just incredibly very, I don't know of another college even like our size that comes even close to that. So incredible students coming up, but 6 of those 8 are converts to Catholicism.
Wow.
Came into the church either while students at Hillsdale or not long after. So I think Hillsdale has something to do with that it gave them something there, not an overt sort of apostolic formation, but very much indirectly through the sort of things we have there. So if your listeners have any interest in hearing more about that, please encourage them. They can find me online and send me an email or call my office. I'm happy to talk to any of them. We'd love to keep getting students here. Father Henry, your own priest there, as well as one of my students, a Catholic convert.
Yes, one of our parish priests. He's awesome. He's just ordained this year. Awesome, on fire priest, and he converted to Catholicism while at Hillsdale. So hard to beat that as a recommendation.
Thanks for that plug. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Okay, well, I'm going to wrap it up there. Again, thanks so much for being on, Nate. I'll have some links on in the show notes to find out more about Hillsdale and about Nate's work there and all his writings and things like that. But until next time, everybody, God love you.